First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Could Florida finally be turning a corner in the fight against COVID-19? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a safe and happy Labor Day weekend. We're back to business this morning, and just ahead, we'll tell you why infectious disease experts say Florida became a perfect breeding ground for the virus and why we are not out of the woods yet. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, how you can kick off Sober September by taking a little break from booze. Good advice for so many of us. That's later. But first this hour, a little bit of good news as we kick off the unofficial start to fall. Florida appears to be finally turning a bit of a corner from record new infections and deaths from coronavirus that have been rampaging the state. Now, new infections were averaging more than 22,000 a day in the last days of August. They have fallen in recent days to about 19,000, a little bit of an improvement. However, recovery could prove quite fleeting. Holiday weekends like the three-day Labor Day holiday have typically acted as a tinderbox for outbreaks, and kids are going back to college campuses, too. Healthcare workers are traumatized. They've witnessed mass suffering and death that could have been averted in this state if only more people had been immunized. Meanwhile, epidemiologists say Florida has taught the nation important lessons as the highly infectious Delta variant of the virus is now accounting for nearly all of the new cases. Even though this state has vaccination rates slightly above the national average, Florida provided ideal conditions for this virus to flourish and kill people. That's because businesses are open. The governor has waged high-profile fights to stop mass mandates at schools, to shield businesses from fines for allowing unvaccinated and unmasked patrons. So much to get into here. Dr. Cindy Prinz is an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Florida in Gainesville, and she says Florida's experience shows that we have to act quickly to stave off an explosion of Delta variant cases. Dr. Prinz, good morning. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
And it's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Well, Dr. Prinz, let's begin with the good news, at least. We are seeing a slight downtick in cases and hospitalizations. That's encouraging. And we, after many months of nothing but bad news, at least we can take a moment to celebrate that.
That is encouraging. It's good news. I was happy to see that we're headed potentially on that downturn in cases. But I also want to be cautious because we need to continue to be very careful. I think what we're seeing is a result of people taking more precautions. We've gotten some more people vaccinated because of this Delta wave. But, you know, this can turn around and go the other way again. So we need to be very, very careful and not think that we're out of this right yet.
Right. And that's been the story all throughout this horrible pandemic. Every time we think we're getting past it, there's another wave. How concerned are you that the Labor Day holiday could trigger another uptick?
I do have some concern about the Labor Day holiday. You know, people are still largely indoors. Our weather is still really warm and humid. And so that can cause a concern for people gathering together. Again, you know, hopefully people have been taking precautions. I know a lot of people have gone back to mask wearing, but it seems to be very much dependent on where you are and who you are, whether you're deciding to wear a mask or not.
Yeah. It's 549-2937. You know, in the early months of the pandemic, there was a big push to vaccinate seniors in Florida. Of course, we have a huge senior population. Most senior citizens did get out and get vaccinated, although there is still an unvaccinated minority among them. And then in more recent months, we've been seeing more unvaccinated people under the age of 50 coming into hospitals, being put on ventilators, dying. In July and August, as the Washington Post reported, and you were quoted in this story over the holiday, older residents accounted for less than 2/3 of the deaths. And so It's just been tragic to watch this, to see people continuing to resist the vaccine, young, healthy people, Dr. Prinz, that could have avoided this.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the worst tragedies we're seeing, because now we have an effective prevention method, at least when we're looking at preventing people from dying of COVID-19, and that's the vaccine. And these vaccines are very, very safe, but there's been a lot of mistrust that people have in them because of rumors about them and misinformation. And it really is sad to see younger people dying who are unvaccinated, and those deaths could have been prevented.
In Orange County, Advent Health has brought in a fleet of refrigerated trucks, mobile morgues to store bodies because hospitals there can't keep up with the deaths. Florida funeral homes are at the breaking point. They are enduring the strain of hundreds of deaths a day. As I mentioned, healthcare workers for a long time now have been begging people to get vaccinated because they are seeing firsthand how horrible this is inside hospitals. Let me ask you about the state's response. Governor DeSantis has been barnstorming the state, promoting monoclonal antibody treatment for COVID. It's called Regeneron. We have a clinic here in Jacksonville. It does help people who are positive avoid serious illness. That said, the governor has also been criticized for not more aggressively pushing masking and vaccination. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when we look at monoclonal antibody therapy, it's very effective. It's definitely a good thing for people to know is available if they do test positive for COVID, and especially if they have some of these risk factors that make them potentially become more ill and if they're unvaccinated. But what we need to remember, it's a basic tenet of public health. Primary prevention is key, and primary prevention means keeping people from getting infected in the first place. And we do that largely with vaccines. Even though we've had breakthrough cases, we know that vaccines are still very effective at preventing a lot of the cases of COVID-19. And then also using masks, because masks are another effective prevention tool. So that's really the message that we need to get out to people. Prevent yourself from getting infected. By the time you're infected, it may be too late. If you're not quick enough in responding to that, then that antibody therapy may be no help to you, and you may wind up hospitalized and dying.
Right. And to add to the misery, unemployment benefits end today, the day after Labor Day. Evictions are ending in the state. So that could also, those two things could spike some more cases.
Absolutely. That's a concern as well. You know, we want people to be able to go back to work. Ideally, we want the state to be able to run most effectively for people to be able to have their job. But people are feeling not confident about going to work in certain places because of the high level of cases. And so that's the problem in being able to really recover fully.
Okay, as we speak with Dr. Cindy Prinz, infectious disease epidemiologist at UF, what are your thoughts about the pandemic post-Labor Day? Cases and hospitalizations in the state are finally ticking down a tiny bit, but it's no cause for relaxing, Dr. Prinz says. You need to keep masking up and get yourself vaccinated. 549-2937. Give us a call. Elizabeth is along I-95 right now. Hi, Elizabeth. Hope you had a good holiday.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had heard that COVID-19 was named that because it was the 19th strain of COVID that had been identified of SARS-CoV. And so I wanted to confirm that's true. And then I had also heard that there are other SARS-CoV strains called 20 and 21. And I wondered if that was true. And then I also heard that the vaccinations are not effective against these newer strains. And I wondered if that was true.
Okay. Thanks, Elizabeth. Dr. Prinz, lots of questions and good ones from Elizabeth.
Yeah, absolutely. Elizabeth, thank you for that. So COVID-19 was actually named 19 because it was emerging and identified in 2019. There are lots of different coronaviruses. So certainly, you know, this is potentially not the last one we're going to encounter, but what we have right now is COVID-19 and then a lot of different variants of COVID-19. To my knowledge, there's no 20 and 21 right now. We hadn't had a new coronavirus emergence, at least not one that was pandemic level in 2020. And I'm not knowing of anything in 2021, but really the designation was by year. And then the other question was about the vaccines and how effective they are against some of the new variants. And that's something that is always kept in mind by the CDC and the WHO and by scientists as well. So when we have a new variant, typically they're going to look first in the lab to see how effective those vaccines may be against that new variant. Lab data can tell you something, but it's not going to tell you everything. Antibodies are not our only response to getting infected. Right now, there's been some concern put out there that this new Mu variant may be a little bit more likely to cause breakthrough infections. But that's really not for certain at this point. It's still being looked at. And so right now, that variant is a variant of interest, something that we don't know a lot about and being watched, but we don't have any solid data to say that the vaccines won't work against it.
5492937. It's my understanding there's maybe a 1 in 5,000 chance of a vaccinated person getting a breakthrough case, Dr. Prinz. But what's your answer to those who are using that argument to avoid getting vaccinated? They believe that if they do get vaccinated, it may not be as effective.
Right. So, you know, vaccines, there are different types of vaccines, and some of our vaccines are very good at just preventing infection completely, and others are not going to always prevent infection, although they're still very good at that. But what they will do is hopefully give you a milder case of the disease if you do get infected and prevent you from being hospitalized and dying. And that's certainly what we're seeing now. Our breakthrough infections, yeah, people can get sick and they can still feel pretty miserable. But those vaccinated people are not the ones making up the majority of those in the hospital and the majority of those dying. It's the unvaccinated people. So, you know, I'm vaccinated, fully vaccinated. I'm happy to be. It doesn't give me, you know, that 100% confidence of I'm not going places without my mask. And I'm not going into crowds right now because we have a lot of Delta. But I still feel protected ultimately that even if I get COVID, I'm not going to be hospitalized and I'm not going to die.
Lots of tweets. Here's one from a listener. We need to pay people to get vaccinated. At this point, what else have we got? You know, Dr. Prinz, there are some efforts to do that. But at the same time, what's your position on mandates? On large companies, some have already started doing this, and other entities mandating that people be vaccinated to continue their employment, or large venues mandating vaccination or a negative test to enter a concert or any area where there's a large number of people. Do you think the country needs to move more in that direction to finally end this?
I think so. You know, we've used vaccine mandates for a long time. You know, children have been mandated to have certain vaccines in order to go to school. There are medical exceptions to that if people are not able to get that particular vaccine. And I think that that is absolutely needed. But overall, I think that companies using vaccine mandates are doing that in order to protect their own bottom line, to make sure that they don't have a lot of people who are out sick, that they're not a site of transmission. And I think that's important for them to be able to get back to their business as usual.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask you as well about another issue that we've been dealing with for weeks now from listeners asking us to talk about ivermectin as a treatment for COVID. It is not an approved or recommended treatment. It's something some people are turning to because they're worried about getting sick, but they refuse to take the vaccine. Can you please explain once again for our listeners, and we've done this several times, why this is a bad idea to take ivermectin for COVID-19?
Absolutely. So ivermectin was initially investigated as a potential COVID-19 treatment. It's a pretty inexpensive drug. It's something that is available across the world, which is important for developing nations. And it showed some effectiveness in cells in the lab, but ultimately you can take something and show effectiveness in cells, and then when you put it into humans, it doesn't show itself to be effective, and that's what's shown with ivermectin. They've tested it in humans. It would be great if it were effective, but it's not. And then in addition to that, people are ignoring that, ignoring the pleas, and then also dosing themselves with ivermectin at doses that are meant for livestock animals. So going out to, you know, places where they will sell this in bulk for people who have farms, and then taking that dose, and it can be toxic in high doses. And there's just not only no reason to use it, I think it's actually counterproductive because people think they're being protected when they take it, and they're not. So it's really critical for people to please stop trying to use ivermectin. I wish it were effective, but it's not. And really, we have something that's effective, and it's called the vaccine.
That's right. Along with masking, distancing, hand washing, these are the proven ways to keep yourself from getting sick, folks, or getting others sick. Our guest right now is Dr. Cindy Prinz, an infectious disease epidemiologist with the University of Florida. Let's go to a few more calls. 549-2937. Antonio in Duval. Antonio, good morning.
Yeah. How you doing, Melissa?
I'm great, thanks. Go ahead.
My comment is about the COVID-19. The shot is very it helped a lot. When I say that is like 3 months ago, if you remember, they had it open on the Regency Mall where you take a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over there, me, my girlfriend, and my little baby girl. I went over there and took the shot. And I used to have a sinus problem before that for almost 10 years. Now I don't have no problem with my sinus problem. I don't know why.
Hmm.
Well, maybe it could be the mask I'm wearing because all the time I go to work, all the time I step from the house, it could be that too. I don't know. But
well, I'm glad to hear that, Antonio. And you haven't gotten COVID?
No, I don't have COVID. Before, one time I had, she had a COVID, and then she gave it to me, the COVID, and I gave it to the baby girl. So and then after that, you know, we treated ourselves inside the house. You know, we drink, you know, all kind of house things, like hot thing, tea, any kind like that. And then after that, well, after we felt better, we took ourselves to the Regency Mall. We took the shot. Thanks God, we're still okay.
I'm so glad to hear that. And I'm glad to hear your sinus problems have cleared up too. Thanks, Antonio.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay.
Have a good day.
You too. Dr. Prinz, could the vaccine have these kind of side benefits like that? Or I'm assuming that needs much more study.
That would need more study. I haven't heard anything that the vaccine would benefit people who have sinus trouble, but I think Antonio is on the right track with thinking that maybe wearing that mask is helpful. You know, a lot of us have allergies, especially this time of year. And I think, you know, masking, we know, helps prevent some of those dust and pollen particles from getting into our system as well. You may hear my frog in my throat. I have allergies too. And, you know, the mask, we don't talk about that added benefit really of masks being beneficial for some folks.
Yeah. And the mask wearing has certainly cut down on flu cases this season and last season. Mark in Arlington. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know I got to be quick, but my perspective is I don't think that these vaccines do a good job of selling themselves. And this is what I mean. So I am vaccinated, but I think a lot of people are sort of saying that they look at these vaccines. So these vaccines, you know, they require two shots instead of one, separated by a few weeks. So it's already not very convenient. I can still get COVID. I can still spread COVID. And, you know, I'm told I still have to wear a mask. So, you know, we don't see a lot of benefit. And then now, you know, every other headline I read is about how the efficacy of the vaccines wane rather quickly now. You know, first, and they're already talking about boosters. Some of them only, you know, they say within 5 months you might need a booster. So all that being said, I think a lot of people are just saying, well, I'm willing to get vaccinated, but I'm just going to wait until there's a better vaccine. And that's my thought. That was my perspective for a long time.
Thanks, Mark. And I think you have given a really good summation of why it's been difficult to convince millions of Americans to get vaccinated. Dr. Prinz, as Mark pointed out, for a lot of people, they view the vaccine as equivalent to being told to eat their vegetables, unfortunately, and they don't see the risk benefit. I don't think quite accurately. They rationalize not getting it for all of the reasons Mark laid out. So it has been difficult to convince a big segment of the population because of those reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate Mark saying that because I think the more we hear from people who say, you know, I had these concerns, but I did get the vaccine, I think that's really important in helping other people make that decision as well. And so for Mark's, you know, certainly, yes, a two-dose vaccine, it would be great if it were only one dose, but that is not what we're working with COVID. Again, some vaccines are one and done, you know, for real, where it's going to be protective of you. There are other vaccines where we need boosters. I look at the hepatitis vaccine, and that's on a similar schedule where you get a dose and another a month later, another 6 months later, and then you have very good protection. And that may be where we're headed with COVID-19. I certainly wouldn't wait for something, quote-unquote, better to come along. These are actually really great vaccines. They're very effective. I don't think you're necessarily going to see, you know, that magical vaccine that is going to be the one and done for COVID-19. So I wouldn't hesitate. I would go ahead and get vaccinated right now.
Yeah. Some hospitals in the U.S. are almost at full capacity, which means that you may or may not get an ICU bed if you get sick or if you are in a car accident or if you have a heart attack. And the hospitals are going to be having to make, they're going to have to make very difficult choices about who gets treated and who doesn't. That's how severe this is, folks. You know, Dr. Prinz, every single day I read an account of someone in this country who refused to become vaccinated and then is sent to the hospital, is on a ventilator gasping for breath, and right before they die, they beg everyone to learn from their mistake and to get vaccinated. These were people who were anti-vaccination, who even posted about it sometimes on social media. Sometimes it's an on-air talk show host. There have been several of those, including at least one here in Florida, who were publicly and proudly anti-vax and then died. And so it's so frustrating to see this because so many more lives could have been saved if it were not for misinformation and political tribalization and a distrust of science and a distrust of expertise on this. So many more lives could have been saved, and we're going to lose more lives because people won't make smart choices. What's your final message for people out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really sad. And I think that we have to, though, you know, lead with some empathy here where people are being given that information. I don't think that most people are deliberately making what I think is, you know, a bad choice. I think that they're being influenced. And so I see a lot of vitriol toward these people who get infected and wind up in the hospital and are not vaccinated. I think we need to turn around and, you know, take a different approach and say, why is this happening? Why are people listening to that information? And how can every individual who believes in this vaccine go and talk to someone who doesn't and answer their questions and have empathy for them?
Thanks so much for that. She's Dr. Cindy Prinz, an infectious disease epidemiologist at UF. Thanks.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead on the show this Tuesday. Later, how you can kick off Sober September this month, but up next.
One of the ways to be more competitive as a community of choice and to better compete with your peer cities is to really elevate the experience of our shared places.
The economics of placemaking. How should Jacksonville activate its waterfront and who pays? That's next. Well, last week, the local coalition Riverfront Parks Now endorsed the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund's recently unveiled Esplanade Plan for the shipyards and metropolitan parklands along the north bank of the St. John's River. It's a way to activate the riverfront. So what is the best way to do that, and how are we going to pay for it? For more, I spoke with James Lima of JPL Plus D. They're a national real estate planning and public policy advisor specializing in the economics of placemaking. So when we talk about activating the downtown Jacksonville riverfront, what are some takeaways from your firm's analysis of this whole process we're seeing play out here in Jacksonville?
Well, the stakeholders in Jacksonville have made a lot of smart moves and strategic investments and recognize that one of the ways to be more competitive as a community of choice and to better compete with your peer cities is to really elevate the experience of our shared places. And waterfronts are some of the most important places in cities that keep drawing people back again and again. And that's relevant for downtown residents, for people who live in the region, for downtown workers and visitors.
Sure. And so what you study is the way cities around the world are really at an inflection point. COVID-19 is straining urban centers' ability to grow as a place for convening, working, living. In Jacksonville, we've got a challenge in appealing to younger, highly skilled and innovative talent. So urban centers need to build the kind of placemaking that will attract that talent. The waterfront district
That's
in Jacksonville,
exactly right.
Yeah, it has the potential to do that. But can we get there is the question.
Absolutely. But it's going to take a public-private effort where there's a greater alignment of interest around that and some really thoughtful planning by the best possible talent to really think about what is it about the places we go that we choose to go again and again that can be more a part of the Jacksonville experience. So shade, ease of strolling, the ideas of loops that connect a number of interesting things that we do in the downtowns and other villages, walkable places that we choose to go to. And that can involve more food and beverage choices, more shopping, more what I call urban perches, places in cities where you can sit at a cafe and watch people go by and feel connected in a community and belonging somewhere, but really comfortable with amenities. So it's everything from being mindful of climate, but also great amenities and services and restrooms and attractive parks. And the stewardship and management of those places is a critical way that all those things can be tied together. So we think a lot about the future of the people who get up every day just thinking about the experience, the quality of experience of downtown Jacksonville.
Activating the waterfront in this manner has really paid dividends in lots of other cities. And so coordination is key, getting all of the players in Jacksonville on the same page. That's often easier said than done. And how to fund something like this. What are you seeing from your perspective on how that's playing out in other metro areas that are trying to do similar work?
In our experience, people would prefer not to have to spend more money toward parks and open space if they don't have to. However, what happens in all the most successful and competitive places is that there is a realization of just how strategic that investment is, both for the individual private property owners and the businesses that are trying to attract talent and retain talent in their places, but also for universities. If I'm trying to bring in a great research candidate, or if I'm the football coach and I'm trying to get somebody to come to Jacksonville, or you know, just anyone who's just thinking, how do I attract talent and investment to this place from people who have a lot of choices. And you start to say, you know what, there's something at stake here that's worth spending some money as a community, and where it's not just government, but it's very much a public-private and not-for-profit collaboration and shared interest. So those are some of the hard conversations to have and say, look, let's align interests, let's communicate this and educate so that everybody realizes not only is there something at stake for their specific interests, but they stand to benefit long-term if they make those commitments. So, yes, more money from city councils that have a better understanding of why there's a good return on public investment for making those kinds of investments. But also real estate value capture to get real estate developers, owners, in some cases businesses, to say, you know what, we're gonna contribute our fair share. And so in a geography that's most relevant for helping pay for those and benefit from those public realm investments, to create an assessment district. And then, again, tapping into the wealth and philanthropy of the region to show all the ways that programming and activation, you know, are things where they can support and really have impact for people from, you know, all the communities in the city.
James Lima, good to get your insights. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Well, the Jaguars are prepping for their first game of the regular season, traveling to Houston to take on the Texans. And it was a fun first weekend of college football. Our director, Josh Torres, is here to talk a little sports. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Melissa.
All right, let's talk about the Jaguars. The Trevor Lawrence Urban Meyer journey officially begins. How are you liking this matchup?
Oh, boy. This is the week the Jags fans have been waiting for. It's time. It's time to see them suit up for the first week of the season. And this matchup is definitely going to be an interesting one because Houston's kind of going through a crisis in their organization. There's a lot of issues going on, particularly in their quarterback room. We won't go too deep into it. But this matchup right now, the Jags are actually favored to win this matchup. The thing that we're really looking forward to, obviously, Trevor, let's see how this offense is going to stack up. Yesterday, Urban Meyer did announce that he expects his offensive line to be back to 100% health. He will have all the starters back. So that's really going to set the tone for what this offensive identity is going to be. He did also say don't really expect a lot of direct runs from Trevor. Expect him to be looking for the pass. Obviously, he will take off and run if he needs to, but don't expect a direct play call for him to run. And on top of that, there's actually something kind of fun happening with Houston. A Jacksonville native, and in fact, an old classmate of mine,
really,
is going to be playing for Houston. DeMarcus Walker, he used to play at Florida State. He also went to high school with me at Sandalwood High School.
Nice.
He used to play for Denver. He got drafted by Denver about 5 years ago, actually. And he signed with Texas with the Texans this offseason. So he will be playing against his old hometown team. And then on top of that, we also have Bulls graduate Mac Jones, who was announced as the new starter for the New England Patriots. They will be taking on the Miami Dolphins this week. So we also need to say good luck to Mac as he starts a big journey.
The 904 representing all over the NFL. Let's talk, if I could, for a minute about Urban Meyer. He really caused a stir throughout the NFL when he said that the team considered vaccination status in their roster decisions.
Yes, he did. You know, he was asked about what they looked at and if that was one of the things that they did check out before when they made their final cuts. Urban admitted that, you know, that was something that they'd look at. And the thing is, you know, Jags fans honestly were very surprisingly, I should actually say unsurprisingly, they defended him right away. And they said, if you think your head coach didn't consider this even a little bit, he's lying to you. Because the thing is, too, the Jags have to consider they have to travel to the UK in just in about a month to play a game against the Dolphins in London. And the thing, and the UK still has travel restrictions on the US. An unvaccinated person in the UK, if traveling from the US to the UK, has to quarantine for 10 days. That does not matter how long you're in the country, you have to be quarantined for 10 days.
Does that mean then that they'll be 100% vaxxed when they go to London?
That is the multi-million dollar question, Melissa, because if a player is not vaccinated, realistically, if they wanted to travel to England, they would have to miss the game the week before because they would have to go well over 10 days before this game to make sure they have the time to quarantine. So it's definitely going to be very interesting if they do make a push to get all their players vaccinated before that game.
We'll watch that. In the meantime, we had so much fun on September 4th with 904 Day. I was thrilled to be part of this big push to celebrate Jacksonville on 904. That's our area code, of course. There was some trash talking from New Orleans about the Saints-Packers game being played here at TIAA Bank Field, saying, oh, there's nothing fun to do here. Jacksonville's no good. And I liked seeing the clap back on 904 Day from everybody on social media.
Yes, everybody in Jax, regardless of their status as a Jags fan, came out to defend Jacksonville. And, you know, it was kind of, a lot of people saw it as unnecessary. I mean, New Orleans, obviously, if you've been paying attention to news, they're going through a very horrible time right now. A lot of the city still does not have power, AC, basic essentials. And the Saints were supposed to open their season this weekend in New Orleans. And when they weren't able to, Jacksonville welcomed them with open arms as they're going to take on the Green Bay Packers this weekend. And, you know, and this columnist kind of came out and just really hit out on Jacksonville to the point where Lenny Curry got involved. And apparently, I haven't really been able to confirm this, but apparently even the owner of the Saints called Mayor Curry to apologize.
Get out.
And I mean, that's just how much hitback came out after this article. Because again, the Jags didn't, the TIA Bank Field, the Jags, they didn't have to do this. They didn't have to say, hey, you know what? You guys need a home for a day. Come on down. We're not there this week. You guys can take the stadium and do everything you need to get ready for your game. They did not have to do that. And so it kind of was a smack in the face in the eyes of a lot of Jags fans and a lot of Jacksonville residents that, you know, we welcome your team with open arms and you kind of hit out at us saying, oh, there's nothing to do there. Why are they going to do it there? And it really, really hurt a lot of people here.
Yeah. Nice to see that, though, that they a city official there, or the team owner, I should say, called the mayor. Let's plug our parking at WJCT Studios for any and all events at TIAA Bank Field.
Yes, we will always have parking for most of those events. And if you're lucky enough, you might even see me out there.
That's right. And we have people who've tailgated in our parking lot for years. It's a family tradition. We always like seeing them. Okay, lots of college football action over the weekend, too.
Oh, yes, there was. The first game I wanted to talk about was one of the bigger ones on Sunday. FSU took on Notre Dame. This is a game that, honestly, I'll admit, I did not really give FSU much of a chance. They have struggled a lot the last few seasons, especially after Jimbo Fisher left to go to Texas A&M. They've really been struggling for a team identity. They've gone through a couple head coaches. They finally found a new one in Mike Norvell. And this game, I thought, okay, they'll probably keep it close for a little bit, and then Notre Dame's eventually going to run away with it. FSU, I mean, they took them the absolute distance, and the story of the night was Mr. Mackenzie Milton. For those of you who do not know who that is, he used to play quarterback for UCF and had an absolutely terrible leg injury. At one point, his doctors thought they were going to have to amputate his leg. Mm. They hoped that when they didn't have to do that, they hoped that one day he would just be able to walk without a limp, let alone step on a football field again. Well, after starting quarterback Jordan Travis had his helmet knocked off during the game, Mackenzie Milton, who transferred to FSU, came in and led the Seminoles back from 10 points down to force overtime against the number 5 ranked team in the country. Unfortunately, FSU did go on to lose 41-38 in overtime. But still,
that's great.
It was such a great story to see. And it was
Exciting for him.
Yeah, and the Seminoles are going to have some questions to see if maybe Milton is their answer. Not that Jordan Travis played a bad game. He did what he could. It was his first start, I believe, and against a tough opponent. But we'll see what the Seminoles do going forward.
Georgia Clemson, Florida FAU, and Miami Alabama all played this weekend.
Yes, they did. Georgia Clemson, that was an all-out defensive battle. Georgia came out on top 10-3, and our own starting quarterback, Trevor Lawrence, was out. Obviously, he graduated from Clemson, led them to a national title. But unfortunately, Clemson did lose, and he lost a bet to his current teammates, who are Georgia alums, and had to go to practice yesterday decked out in Georgia Bulldog gear.
That's cute.
With this game, definitely look for the Bulldogs to have a very, very strong season. And then we go down to Gainesville, where Florida had more of a tune-up game against FAU. They beat them 35-14. Starting quarterback Emory Jones had a little bit of a shaky game. He only threw one touchdown and two interceptions and only threw for 113 yards. But the big story was Anthony Richardson. His backup quarterback ran for 160 yards and with a rushing touchdown. And the best part is he wore number 15, the old number of Mr. Tim Tebow, the guy who made really the running quarterback game famous at UF. So that was definitely great to see, and we're going to look forward to what Florida does next. And then the last game we want to talk about, which I have to say a quick apology to producer Heather Schatz, was Miami-Alabama. This game was over as soon as it started. Alabama absolutely dominated the game. They beat them 44-13. Starting quarterback for Alabama, Bryce Young, threw for four touchdown passes. Alabama was up 27-0 before Miami was even able to get over the 50-yard line.
Oh, that's brutal.
It was a bad, bad game for Miami.
All right. Last but not least, professional women's surfing. A competition is coming to the beach this November.
Yes, I am actually very, very excited for this. I used to live at the beaches. I love surfing. And yeah, Mayor Chris Hoffman of the beaches made this announcement last Wednesday. The competition is going to have a lot of great women surfers coming out, including Florida native and Olympic athlete Carolyn Marks, as well as Tokyo Olympic gold medal winner Carissa Moore will all be out there to compete. And there's going to be a lot more events going on. There's going to be 12 live concerts during the weekend. There's going to be an esports competition, an all-female DJ competition, and a lot more activities all throughout the weekend. If you want to come out, it's going to be in November. It's going to be November 12th through the 14th. There's going to be a little every single day. The surfing will start at 8 a.m. and run to 5 p.m. And then the festival village that they're running, where all these events are going to be open from 12 to 10 on that Saturday and 12 to 6 on that Sunday. So everybody come out, watch some great surfing, and have a really fun weekend.
How cool. That is going to be a great weekend at the beaches. And follow Josh on Twitter for all of your sports news and notes and some other fun stuff. Our own Josh Torres, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
And in a moment, taking a break from booze, we're going to tell you about National Recovery Month and Sober September, the new campaign getting underway this week. That's next with Tracy.com. You know her as Tracy Collins, too. We'll be right back.
Hamilton at the Times Union Center for a three-week engagement, September 29th through October 17th. Be in the room where it happens. More info at fscjartistseries.org.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community, featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at VickersLanding.com.
What if anxiety could actually work in our favor? Dr. Wendy Suzuki is a neurologist at the Center for Neuroscience at New York University, and she joins us to discuss how we can master stress to put it to good use. Her new book is called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Tanya Mosley. After the 9/11 attacks, many Muslim Americans were inspired to deepen their faith, even as Islamophobia swept the nation.
And I think that there was this real hope in America that religion could play a positive role in the world.
Muslim Americans reflect on 9/11. That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Some of the Taliban's most influential leaders were released from Guantanamo Bay in 2014. They were part of a prisoner exchange for the return of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. But the rise of the Taliban is raising new questions about those still held at Guantanamo Bay and the president's plan to close it. On the next 1A, what's next for those in prison and those now in power?
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, September is National Recovery Month, and to honor those in recovery and all of you who maybe are just sober curious, the Sober September campaign is underway, encouraging you to go sober for this month. I spoke about it with Tracy Collins. You also know her as Tracy.com. She detailed her recovery in her compelling book, Stumbling Into Sobriety. Here's that conversation. Tracy.com, always so good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about Sober September. What is Sober September?
So Sober September is it's a movement, a challenge, if you will, that coordinates with the National Recovery Month, which is in September. And it's perfect timing because it's during the time when people kind of are coming off of the partying of the summer and then taking a little break in between the festivities that are coming up starting October 31st through New Year's Day. And so it's in September, so I always like to joke that it's the teachers that are getting a break from having this long, fun summer. And
yeah.
I'm sure that this year in particular, it definitely came at a good time. But in all seriousness, it's for people who are sober curious, folks who just maybe want to hit reset from the summer. And, just a good time for an excuse to give your liver a break.
That's right. And this can be a good reset for so many people. Now, you, of course, wrote a powerful book, Stumbling Into Sobriety, about your journey and your alcoholism and the life you're living today as someone who's sober. So you come at this from a very personal perspective.
I do, and I think it's a good opportunity for people to take a look at their own drinking habits, because I know for me personally, I started to question a lot of the things that I was doing. And so Sober September is a good opportunity for people who want to do it for health reasons, but also for people who maybe want to take a closer look at themselves. And so I can tell you from my own experience, I did a dry January, and that was pretty eye-opening for me as far as what my issues were.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So people can expect some positive results from this in trying to be sober through the month of September. Anything negative they should look out for as well?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, getting sober for a month, you will be shocked after the first 2 weeks of being able to sleep better, less anxiety, more focus. But the negative things that you want to look out for is, can you make it till the end of September? Because if you can't, then that might be a hint that you may need to take a look at a bigger problem. The other thing is, Studies show that when people who do not have a problem with alcohol come off of Sober September, they tend to change their drinking habits in a positive way for several months afterwards. People, on the other hand, like myself, who are alcoholics, what ends up happening, the thing that I noticed and I speak to in my book, is that when I got off that 30-day break, I binged immediately.
So that's when you realized, okay, I may have a chemical dependency.
Well, I don't know if that was the exact moment, but it was definitely a stepping stone. There's always lots of little moments that lead to the big plunge, for sure.
Sure, sure. And people can learn more about this because you have a live author reading coming up from your book, yes?
I do. And you are included in that book, Melissa Ross, full disclosure.
I'm honored. I'm totally honored to even be mentioned.
And yes, so just to kind of raise awareness, and also I recently had received some negative reviews, which I didn't take, you know, personally. I took it as a moment of self-reflection to go back, because I wrote this book in my first year of sobriety. So of course I'm a very different person today than I was that first year. And so I decided, you know, now is a good time to go back and take a look at where I was, and then decide, you know, where I want to be moving forward. So it's also a great opportunity for people to kind of get a hint, a glimpse into someone who lived it. If you are just, I like to say, even if you're just nosy, go ahead and tune in. But if you want to hear some of my aha moments that made me realize that I had an issue, but also aha moments of how awesome sobriety really is, please tune in to my Facebook page, Stumbling Into Sobriety, which is facebook.com/SISJax. And September 1st through the 16th, I will be reading from a chapter each evening at 9 p.m. And yeah, it's, you know, not altruistic. I'm doing it for myself, too, to take a look back and see what I want to do moving forward to help more people.
Check it out on Facebook, everybody, as we mark Sober September with Tracy.com, facebook.com/SISJax. She reads from Stumbling Into Sobriety. It's her compelling memoir. And this is such a great reminder for all of us to just drink less, go sober for the month, and as you said, give your liver a break, and your spirit too. Tracy Collins, so good to talk to you always. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to senior producer Heather Schatz and associate producer Catherine Hobbs. Happy Rosh Hashanah to them both. Director Josh Torres, always doing a great job driving this bus. And thanks to editorial director Jessica Palumbo. Keep your feedback coming. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Catch our podcast up later today, and we'll be back again here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.